Here we gather in a ring, here a garland fresh we fling. Flowers are we just blossoming, blossoming together.
We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Good folks, all a word with you, what a world to bring us to. We shall make the world anew, all of us together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. We are growing, but one day, all of us as one will say, none shall slave and none shall slay, all shall work together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Hand to hand, how far we reach, each for all and all for each. Thus we play and thus we teach, hearts and hands together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Now our clasping hands we raise, holding high a song of praise, song of hope for better days, all people linked together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Forward stepping row by row, waves of freedom on we flow, singing, shining as we go, comrades all together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together.
I could crochet him.
Thanks to the diligence of Sarah, somebody is coming to get the hot tub that we've been trying to get rid of.
Yeah, weird old hot tub.
You've had to put up with so many questions of the same thing, even though we have no idea about the condition of this hot tub, because it was left, it was just abandoned, and you
came
on the scene.
But wait, can you tell us about the condition? Does it work?
Yeah, exactly. No. Can I see the inside of it? Can I see the stickers that are on
the
side
pump?
Of the filter? And I'm like, no, it's free. It's free because we don't want to deal with it. That's part of it.
That's the whole.
You want a free hot tub, man? That's
what you got.
You just show up and you take it.
Yeah, because we don't have any. Yeah, I remember somebody asking you about a pump, and you're like, I don't even know what the pump is.
What is this? I couldn't even take a picture of the pump if you wanted me to. I don't know which one it is.
I don't know what you're talking about. Here's a picture of the guts that have been splayed open of it. Like, this is the part that we can see. If you see a pump there, you tell me. That's,
All right, here's a quiz. Identify the pump.
We're here to pump you up.
Hi, Brenna. This is Yana from Solidarity House.
Hi, Yana. Thanks so much for inviting me to do this interview. So my name is Brenna Cussin-Anglada, and I live at St. Isidore Catholic Worker Farm, which has been in existence. I'm one of the co-founders and community members. We founded it with my husband Eric and I, along with another family of four, co-founded the community in 2016 after having already lived together in a larger community, New Hope Catholic Worker Farm, for about 7 years. So we've all been living together for about 10 years. Our community is just about 3 years old specifically. We're in southwest Wisconsin, which is Ho-Chunk and Meskwaki territory. I've been a part of the Catholic Worker movement, so our community is one of about over 200 communities worldwide, mostly in the U.S., of this larger network of communities. I've been a part of that for about 20 years, I've lived in intentional community for most of my adult life. And just a little bit about St. Isidore, we live on about 25 acres. We try to raise most of what we eat. We're still working toward that goal, so definitely not there yet. But we cook and heat with wood. We use solar for a lot of our energy needs. Since we're in Wisconsin and really close to Iowa, we call ourselves farmers, but I don't think our a lot of our neighbors would call us farmers. They'd probably call us more like homesteaders. But we try a lot to share our abundance with lots of people, including those who are in need. And we do a lot of hospitality here. So we have guest rooms that are usually always full, either from visitors, strangers who've been recommended to us, or folks who are in need of a place to stay for a while. Yeah, we do a lot of educational workshops here. So that's kind of who I am and how I spend my time, I guess, on a day-to-day basis. The Catholic Worker has been around since 1933, so over 80 years. Dorothy Day, as you mentioned, along with Peter Morin, who was a French immigrant. Dorothy Day was born in the U.S. in New York. The two of them founded the movement in 1933. They founded the movement originally as a newspaper trying to explore and explain the Catholic social teaching. She was a recent convert to Catholicism, and before she had become Catholic, she had been a radical socialist turned anarchist who was very critical of capitalism, nationalism, militarism, and most of U.S. foreign policy and economic policy. She became Catholic and was searching for a way to kind of blend her radical politics with her newfound faith, and started this newspaper. And within, I think, a couple months of the newspaper being started, her community kind of popped up around her in New York, and then communities across the country started popping up, communities dedicated to providing hospitality to those in need. So whether that took the form of taking folks in who needed a place to stay, or providing food to people who were hungry, or some communities today, for example, will provide housing for folks who are visiting their loved ones in prison instead of those folks having to pay for a hotel. So communities usually perform some sort of, in the Christian tradition, it's called work of mercy, like feeding the hungry, visiting the imprisoned, caring for the sick, welcoming the stranger. The community is also traditionally pacifist and has been very outspoken against, particularly U.S., since it's a U.S.-based movement, U.S. Foreign policy and military policy, and has adhered to pacifism for the most part. It doesn't necessarily mean everyone in the movement is pacifist, and for sure everyone in the movement is not Catholic. I am. Our community happens to be, but we welcome like any expression of faith or people of no religion or faith at all. People are just usually attracted to the principles of living in community, working with those who are marginalized. And then we also have a small contingent of us who are farmers, believing that the earth is one of the most marginalized. Caring for creation is also a work of mercy. Since 1933, nonviolent activism has been a huge part of our tradition as well.
Well, I would love to hear your valve-turning story and, you know, sort of what led up to it, what motivated you to this action, what's happened, and what the legal fallout has been for you.
Sure. Maybe I'll start a little macro and then get a little more micro. Of course, the state of our climate and climate change has been a motivating factor for me, but probably even more so is over the last several years for me as a white person, or a person who's been racialized as white in this country, just starting to learn more about the reality of the history of colonization on this continent, what it's done both to indigenous people of this continent and to the land, and also the present reality of indigenous people struggling for their own, to protect their own treaty rights. So that learning process for me has been a huge motivating factor. And coming as a Christian, and having this tradition of needing, before reconciliation can happen, like some sort of repair and an attempt to repair the harm that's been done, has been a motivating factor. And then seeing the incredible witness of Indigenous people at Standing Rock, and then knowing that the first Val Turners were actually First Nations members in Canada, at least some of them, just seeing Indigenous people taking on some of the biggest risks in order to protect our earth, and then knowing myself coming from a pretty relatively privileged background, feeling like it's also my turn to sort of step up to the challenge, has been a huge, what has been motivating me, I guess, most spiritually. but more specifically, so as part of the Catholic Worker, every year in the Midwest, at least the Midwest communities, get together every year, usually in the spring, for some sort of action of resistance. One local community who's working on a specific issue will call the rest of the communities to come and assist them in that issue. And last year, 2018, in April of 2018, we were called to Duluth, Minnesota, and the Catholic Worker communities up there were wanting to support the broader resistance to Enbridge's proposal to expand Line 3. And they had been working some with the Ojibwe community up there. Members from the Fond du Lac community spoke at our gathering, lawyers, activists, spiritual leaders in the Fond du Lac Ojibwe community. We got to hear from, as well as Duluth activists, and we culminated the weekend after learning a lot about the Line 3 expansion by breaking into and occupying an illegal pipe yard that Enbridge was hosting, was holding pipes there illegally without permits. So we drew attention to this by placing sacred objects in the pipe yard. And we figured, since we were breaking the law by trespassing, we assumed we would be arrested, but we stayed there all day and into the night and were not arrested, which I think is largely due to the fact that most of us in the yard, I think almost all of us were white, so I'm sure that had a lot to do with our being treated so well. And as a follow-up, one of the Duluth Catholic workers, Michelle Nar-Obed, one of my fellow Valturners, put kind of a call out to some other Catholic workers, invited people personally and largely to see if anyone wanted to continue with a follow-up action. And I accepted that invitation, and so did Allison Pullman and Daniel Yildream, my fellow Valturners. And we've been planning for several months, carefully and spiritually and emotionally and practically. It took a lot of planning. And then do you want me to tell you about the action itself, what we did? Or?
Yeah, great. Go ahead and tell us about it.
Sure. So we cut a chain with bolt cutters to get into a site in northern Minnesota where Enbridge has manual shutoff valves, so in case of an emergency or if they needed to shut down the oil and for some reason the electricity wasn't working, they could shut these valves down. So we went in and notified Enbridge that we were in there, and we locked ourselves in, and we said our plan was to manually shut off the valves, but if they wanted to do it remotely, we wanted to give them the opportunity to do that before we shut them down ourselves. And so they took us up on that, and they shut them down first. And we were arrested by the county police and spent a couple nights in jail. And we are now facing one misdemeanor charge for breaking the lock when we broke our way in to the fence, and a felony charge as well, which carries a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and $10,000, and the felony is for aiding and abetting attempted damage to pipeline property.
Yeah, and so if people want to know more about who you are, the website is four necessity MN for Minnesota, right?
Well, so we got the free website. We might, now that donations have been rolling in, we might actually spring for an easier website. I think there's like a bit.ly then /for necessity. And I don't think the MN is part of the email. So it's bit.ly/4necessity. And that will bring you to the website. Sorry for all of the extra letters, but it was free.
One of the things that I was really intrigued with is this connection between you all, you know, living in intentional community, and that there's this whole network of Catholic worker houses that form sort of a subset of the intentional communities movement in the United States, and that you're a very activist movement, and it fits really well with some of the interesting thinking about the relationship between intentional communities and activist work. And, you know, you say in your bio that you joined an intentional community basically right out of college, and I'm curious how you feel like that experience has shaped you as an activist.
In countless ways. Probably the first thing that comes to mind is the incredible experience, especially in our mainstream society. It's so rare for young adults to get to live in community with their elders, with people a decade or 2 decades or 4 decades older than them. And I got to have that experience and continue to get to have that experience, even though I don't live in the same house right now. We have so many wonderful elders in our community. So I was inspired right away in my very early 20s by elders in our movement, like Kathy Kelly, Scott and Claire Schaefer Duffy, Brian Terrell. There's countless others who have put their lives on the line and have risked time and spent time in prison for what they believe in. And I got to, you know, live with these people, eat with these people, talk with these people, be inspired by these people. So at the time that I joined the Catholic Worker, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Iraq were still happening. And I personally knew a lot of people, both my age and older than me, who were traveling to Iraq with Voices in the Wilderness. It has now recreated itself as Voices for Creative Nonviolence after they got in trouble with the law. But Voices in the Wilderness was organizing delegations of U.S. citizens to break the law by breaking sanctions and by traveling to Iraq and carrying with them much-needed antibiotics, which were not allowed into the country at the time. And I think the statistic from UNICEF is over 500,000 children under the age of 5 died as a direct result of these sanctions. I got to see people who would just take the clothes on their back, 2 suitcases full of antibiotics and other medicines and materials needed by hospitals in Iraq, and travel. And this kind of witness is so powerfully shaped me and who I wanted to be. And I just saw people who lived what they believed in and just did it. I hadn't really, I grew up with the Catholic faith, and then here were people, whether they were Catholic or not, doing the things that I was taught we were supposed to do, but I hadn't really seen it in action before.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because there's such a huge difference between like reading somebody's story online or in a book and sort of admiring someone from afar versus eating dinner with them every night and sort of getting to know them as like real, like multidimensional people. And it feels like that's a really rich thing that living in community with someone can give you that's really different, even though they're still that same inspiring person that lots of people probably heard about, you know?
Yes, yeah. Seeing them just humbly folding all of the laundry up. Like, I lived with a couple named Scott and Claire Schaefer Duffy, and they raised their 4 children and took in folks off who would otherwise be living on the street. And I would, every day see them folding the laundry of the folks who would otherwise be living on the street but who were staying with them, and cooking dinner, all vegetarian meals, and, running their kids to this and that piano lesson. And then, now I'm going on a trip to Iraq to deliver medicine. It was all just this seamless garment of, this is just what we do. This is what Christians do. This is how we live in the world. And it's all part of the same thing. And it made it really like real for me, like seeing that, this is possible. It's not just some, although I do think they're saints, but it's not this like saint on a pedestal. They're just real everyday people. And right away I knew it was possible. This is a life that I could live. This is something I could do. Because I just had constant people witnessing that around me. So again, I live with my husband and another family of 4, and then often other people who are staying with us. But I am like eternally grateful to my community members who, since we live on a farm, they literally have to keep the fire going. Right now it's pretty freezing out here in the Midwest. So they're like keeping the fire going, making sure we have enough wood, keeping the cow milked. I'm one of the main milkers here on our farm, but I haven't been able to do that a lot over the last few months because I've been gone a lot. And then, I come home to this big, beautiful pot of chili when after I got out of jail, I come home and, dinner is cooked and I have the support and love of my community. I will say I have, our action, because we had planned it so well, I did not really experience a lot of trauma, but I know a lot of other activists, especially for what people had to face out at Standing Rock. I can imagine, and I know that a lot of people went through a lot of trauma and traumatic experiences. They experienced a lot of violence. And the importance of coming home to a community who loves you and will be taking care of you is, I guess, undescribable. I can't think of the word, inexplainable. I mean, it's so huge to have that community rooting you and holding you. Also, like, in our community and in other communities, it's kind of beautiful that we can kind of take turns at different parts of our lives. Right now, I'm not a mother of young children, and my community members, one of them is a mother of young children, and one is a father of young children. So right now is sort of my turn in life to be able to do these kinds of actions. But in the future, perhaps it will be their turn, and then I can be the one staying home, keeping the fire going. And then when we're sad or depressed or scared, it's just really important to have other people in our larger network, a larger community network that can tell us, well, this is what it was like for me when I went through the court system, or when I went to prison, or when I did something like this. And just to have elders giving advice, and then have people who are younger than me who are excited, that kind of keep me inspired. Yeah, I think community, I know some people maybe do it without community, but I can't imagine how. Yeah, my community member, Mary Kay, likes to say that of all the ways that we live counterculturally, like, we have compost toilets, we heat and cook with wood, we earn wages that fall below the taxable income because of our opposition to over half of federal income taxes going to the military. So because we live communally, we're able to earn less individual income because we pool our resources. But of all the ways we live counterculturally, the one that people, at least that we get the most reaction from in our small area in the Midwest, is the fact that we live with other people. People get kind of freaked out by that. I think it's one of the most grown-up things that we can do is learn how to live well with other people. It has allowed me, and I'm sure you and many other people who live communally, it allows for so much emotional and spiritual growth. We and our community have implemented we pray most mornings together. We hold a period of silence, and that's 5 days a week, except one of the days, instead of regular prayer, we have a reconciliation ritual, because living together means we need to confront problems, because we hurt, of course, like, we're human, so we hurt one another's feelings. So we set aside a time to have apologies and talk about things that have bothered us that maybe somebody else has done, and we affirm one another. And I feel like our society is so conflict avoidant. We don't know how to deal with conflict, so we either avoid it or we deal with it by we deal with it really badly by yelling or just like breaking off the relationship. And so living in community, I think, has taught us how to deal with conflict in a really healthy way. Also, living in community has allowed us to more live who we are authentically as human beings and what we believe the world should look like. Again, we're not even close to perfect. We make compromises all the time. However, like, we challenge one another to, okay, so we got solar panels because it's something that we believe in. We try to raise a lot of our own food because we don't want to rely on people whose labor is being exploited to do it for us. And we know a lot of people who want to live more closely their values and their ideals, but whose, quote, real world jobs are the reason or their excuse for not being able to find the time to do the things that they really believe are important. So we feel like we're actually living much more the way we feel like we're called to live, and are really grateful for the way we get to live our lives. So, yeah, I don't feel like it's checking out at all. I guess I would want to say that I am coming as a white person who grew up with relative economic privilege. So I realize that a lot of the things I'm saying about living in community is like work that I've had to do from the society and the sort of community that I've come from. So I don't think that everybody needs to join intentional community in the way that I have. But I think as a white person of economic privilege, it's like an incredible learning tool and an incredible way to live in the world.
Do you want to say anything else about what keeps you in community? I mean, you've been at this for a couple decades now, and you've stuck with it, and it seems like you've sort of settled in, and that this is just your life. It's not a phase or anything like that. This is really who you are and what you're doing with your life. So what keeps you in community?
Yeah, I looked at this question beforehand, and I thought, what does keep me in community? Because I don't think about it that much. It just, you're right. It just is what I do, or is what my life is. But I thought about a phrase that a woman I used to live in community with, Claire, the first couple I ever lived in community with, Claire Schaefer Duffy. I remember her distinctly one day saying to me, when I asked her a similar question, she said, "You know, Brenna, I couldn't imagine living any other way." And that was my answer. I think it's the most beautiful and meaningful way I can imagine living. And so, yeah, that's it. I think that's my answer.
Okay, so one more question. So you talk in your bio about, and you've talked in this interview already about the kind of growing awareness of the indigenous land that you live on and your indigenous neighbors. And wondering if you could tease out a little bit more how that awareness has deepened or changed your activism.
A huge learning curve. And so it's still kind of messy. I'm still learning a lot. But over the last several years, I have learned a ton. And Eric, my husband, and I have really prioritized in our lives trying to develop relationships with people who live in local indigenous communities. So we have about 2.5 hours south of us is a Meskwaki settlement, and about 3 hours north of us is a large Ho-Chunk community. And also in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota, there are several Ojibwe reservations. So we have prioritized any time somebody from one of these communities is speaking, giving a public talk, or they're hosting an event, we really try to attend and listen and read and learn. And so our activism and my activism has been really shaped by hearing what people are already doing and how we can join and support in that work, rather than I think for a long time my activism, while I still think it was beautiful and wonderful and exciting and good, but it was very centered around what other Catholic workers were a very largely white community. So we would be protesting war or protesting some sort of militarization of schools or even immigration, which is a very, well, militarization too, but immigration is, you know, largely affects people, disproportionately affects people of color. And so that was sort of blind of me and of us to think that we could do a lot of activism without more collaboration. And so I think I'm learning how to better collaborate and be in support of what other folks are doing, and then also trying to figure out how to know when to just take action on my own without always needing to do such heavy collaboration, but kind of getting a sense of what would be a supportive action and what would, when it's time to sort of take a back seat and let others lead, and when it's time to step up and use the gifts that our community has. So I'm still kind of trying to figure that out, I guess, but it's a huge awareness for me, and I think the more that I build relationships and find out what issues are affecting other communities, particularly indigenous communities, yeah, the more I learn about that, I just think it's a much more informed, it's, I guess, much more informed activism, I guess, than it maybe used to be. I guess I do want to mention that as part of our ongoing action from Turning the Valve, we are really hoping to argue the necessity of our action in court, in the face of climate change. We're wanting to use the necessity defense to argue that our action was necessary. And I think in the state of Minnesota, if we do get to go to trial, as it's looking so far that that's what's going to happen, then we will definitely be able to use the necessity defense in the state of Minnesota. We're hoping that this will take us through. Yeah, I mean, of course, there'd be a huge sense of relief if our charges were dropped. I'm not going to lie about that, but we are hoping that we'll get to make this argument in court. Thanks for doing this podcast, and I'm looking forward to hearing more episodes. We don't have internet here, so at home, so I haven't had a lot of time to listen, but I'm pretty excited now that I've talked to you in person. I'm like, I got to find out more about you and what's going on. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. Thank you so much. Take care, Brenna.
Having this conversation left me unprepared for the level of emotion I have tied to this topic, how much grave importance I hold in this topic, and I say grave with painful, pointed purpose. The event that sparked the necessity of this conversation in the context of this community was small by the account of the person experiencing it, in the context of all the things that could happen and are happening elsewhere. But it wasn't the kind of small that should be dismissed. Despite the episode being about my work and contributions to our work as people fighting for anti-oppression, our podcast episode had been published with two separate instances of misgendering. When I say this was a small event, I don't want that to be misconstrued to be synonymous with unimportant or meaningless. The instances took place over fractions of a second, so they were small in time. They were not spoken out of malice or ill intent, so they were of small weight mentally to those that spoke them. When I downloaded the episode to listen to it for myself, they made me feel small. Unseen, even while listening to a literal showcase of a piece I'd written and an interview I'd done with the organization from which we drew the name for the episode. I felt simultaneously celebrated and rendered non-existent. And I'm lucky. I consider myself in a rare place where when I tearfully message the people who love me to let them know that something happened and it hurts, they listen. Matt and Yana both made public apologies for the public transgression, and we set ourselves the task of talking about it and the impact of misgendering in general on the podcast. And earlier, I made reference to a first time we tried to have that conversation. The day before Trans Visibility Day, we had set a very impromptu discussion to happen that evening. Matt and I set the time basically in passing, expecting it to be a short, matter-of-fact piece that addressed the issue and opened the door for further conversation, but in many ways moved on from the moments of invalidation. Yana only heard about the conversation happening, also in passing, and at the time expressed her want of participation that highlighted its importance in a way in hindsight I appreciate deeply. When we did meet up to start talking, Matt informed us that he had also been thinking about doing another talk with our time about issues that we'd been facing as a community, looking for new members. We could have either two 30-minute long conversations or two 20-minute long, whatever we felt like. And since we have a person here who's thinking of joining, we should invite her to the conversation. Matt went ahead and messaged her. She responded and was coming over. All of these things were being said while my brain was shorting out. Right before I had left the main house to head over to the office where we record, I'd been looking through all of the different articles that I wanted to reference, different trans experiences that come together to document our existence and all the varied struggles that existence entails. As I was processing the new change in plans, I was also trying to speed read through an article from a Jewish trans man about how one of Trump's onslaughts against the trans community, a memo that graciously defines what it is to be a man or a woman and nothing else and only with the right parts, feels akin to the Nuremberg laws, where Jewish people were denied passports and crucial life-saving rights in Nazi-era Germany. I was thinking about how much time it would take to do this conversation justice, and how much time and how that feels physically impossible. I was thinking about how I hadn't articulated, even to myself, the depth of vulnerability I feel in talking about this. And now, after talking a bit more about some of the struggles we've had as a community with membership, with another community mate, I realize that the conversation Matt was hoping to add is absolutely intrinsically tied to the conversation I was expecting to have. Because Matt and Yana both supported me and chose me when we were a 5-member group with 2 TERFs in the mix. For those at home who don't know, TERF is the term for trans exclusionary radical feminists. People who use bioessentialism, incorrect and outdated notions of biological sex that have been repeatedly debunked by biologists for literally decades now, to invalidate the existence of trans women in particular, but broadly trans people. They do sometimes very violent things and in general don't think we should exist. And when they revealed themselves, the members of our group, and told me that I was mentally ill for existing, Matt and Yana stood by me. The TERFs were considered non-members as of that very fucking second, and Yana spent time drafting new policy for the community that would make that a well-documented fact. We are a radically trans-accepting, welcoming, embracing, and loving community, and that is built into who we are very consciously. If you're not down with queers, we are not down with you. And my apology to any trans people listening that dislike the term queer for themselves. I respect you and the words that fit who you are. My comfort word is queer for both my gender and sexuality and personality. Anyway, this is a long preamble to the conversation, and I appreciate your listening, because this shit is important. Scrolling through my Facebook feed, I found another event that happened the day before a Trans Day of Visibility. Ashanti Carmen, a trans woman in DC, was shot multiple times until murdered near the DC line in Prince George's County. I could use that name as a starting point to list a whole fuck ton of other names, but I'm hoping you get the point with only one name and understand that her story is one on repeat in the back of the minds of most trans people as we try to live out our truth. The more visible, the more vulnerable. And I'm still sitting here today talking about who I am and making it known who I am as readily as possible, because I think it's important. And I honestly don't know what else to say, but I am hoping that it has a dialogue of sorts, but
I just want to start from really deep respect for you and hanging in there with us. I mean, I know we've had your back, but you've also been there for us in so many ways. Like, it feels like it's not a one-way relationship. And we have fucked up, you know, not just in the incident that got recorded, but there's, you know, a couple times a week at least, probably a lot more than that, that I don't catch, and that we're still in there working on it together. And I have really deep appreciation for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. I also want to name, which I think you said, but maybe not quite as explicitly as I want to say it, is that these, like, small incidents of misgendering contribute to an environment where trans people can be shot to death, and that it's not, they're not separate from each other.
Yeah.
And so those of us who are cisgendered, I think, have an obligation. It's our work that needs to be done, and the burden of that work is currently falling on trans and NB folk, but mm-hmm. it's not actually your work, it's ours.
I was thinking back to, like, there are Facebook friends that I know, there's a professor, actually, who's getting repeatedly misgendered, and it's affecting her mental health to a degree, and, like, mm-hmm. level of just day-to-day torment, because, yeah, so many different reasons. Either you don't pass correctly, quote-unquote, or you haven't gone through the right hormonal treatments to be considered who you actually are, or because you were in a place where you're just not allowed to exist as you are there, and or when you aren't, when you don't feel safe physically being able to come out, and so you go through years knowing that you are someone other than what you were told you are. It's a massive mental disconnect that is hard to wrestle with. It would definitely be a lot easier, and it becomes easier for me when I have people who are willing to do the work of correcting themselves and not putting it on me. So thank you.
I think it's important what Yana said too, that it is our work, and like, especially, I mean, there's never an excuse, but especially with those that we know. I read someone online who I now can't remember, but it was the idea that basically that, you know, we are able to change, you know, if you don't know the gender of a baby, you know, we're ever able to change like our perception and our coding in our brains of that person almost immediately in how we talk to them. And if we're consistently misgendering trans and NB people in our lives that we care about, like, we're not, part of that is that we're not doing the work that we need to do, like, in terms of really thinking about, like, that person and how we, do you know what I mean? We're just, mm-hmm. our brains are being lazy and just sort of clapping like the pre-made label on instead of really like considering, you know, like who is Scully and how do they feel as a when I say how do they feel, I don't mean your feelings, which are important, but I mean like how... You know, you have...
How
like
do I feel in my skin?
Our conception of... You know what I mean? We're not taking the time to see you accurately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's... There's no excuse for that. Because you know...
It seems like of all the kind of shitty arguments that people make about... honoring, you know, people's self-identified pronouns, that the shittiest is this, you know, why is this so, you know, like, why do I have to change, you know, like, this is so obvious, when in, like Sarah said, in so many other contexts, that's not true at all. And in fact, the entire concept of gendering has always been really fluid, mm-hmm. when people have wanted it to be fluid.
I mean, like, when you misgender someone's dog, people are more receptive to it than people. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Well, if you have a situation where you go in and meet someone's dog,
right.
and like, oh, what's her name? And, oh, his name is Fluffy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah. oh, sorry, okay, him. Mm-hmm. And then you do immediately make that switch. Mm-hmm. That mental switch is much easier for the dog than the person.
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, even the equally silly conversation around they, which, you know, in certain contexts has always mm-hmm. been used as mm-hmm. as an inclusive pronoun, mm-hmm. and suddenly it's you know, oh well, now it's political mm-hmm. to use it. That doesn't make any sense. So mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
Well, yeah. So 16th century was actually used as a singular pronoun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fun fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so in some contexts, like if you have somebody who's lost their wallet at a bar, mm-hmm. and you try and return that wallet, and you say, do you say he or like someone? So you,
their
someone
name's
has
Kelly.
Left her his yeah. or her wallet. I'm like, no, you say someone has left their wallet.
Or yeah, if you didn't right. see their right. name.
Yeah.
Or if their name was you know, culturally
or someone,
ambiguous in some
or someone
way.
Left
yeah.
their backpack and there mm-hmm. wasn't anything
right.
in there. That,
right.
You know, so it was just
yeah.
someone
who
left
their backpack.
Fucking
sure,
thing.
Yeah, it's not, yeah.
And even if it wasn't, I think that, again, the anti-trans sentiment of, you know, It's a very prescriptivist way mm-hmm. to think of language. Like, I think these are a lot of the same people that don't want to recognize and acknowledge that language changes. It mm-hmm. always has. It's always,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times, I think, like, you know, marginalized communities are on the forefront of that language change, and it's like the establishment is like really always really reluctant to, you know, it takes a really long time for slang and things like that to, like, you know, be added to, you know, the Webster's or Oxford English Dictionary.
What we codify as appropriate language actual English.
Academic language or professional language. That's a lot of box of words.
And then the darker side of that is, you know, people who are vehemently anti-trans, you know, fascists, who then deliberately do that because it's part of that same sort of spectrum of, you know, not only am I not going to do the easy thing, I'm actually going to go out of my way to continue to use this as a weapon, which then proves the importance of, in a way, kind of proves the importance of language, right? That they consider it a weapon just as readily as a member of an oppressed community might consider it a structure of strength and solidarity. So, you know, but that's the thing about fascism is they always know what they're doing. They always know they sort of get the stupid joke that they're telling. And that's a really good example of that.
You know, one of the things that's been interesting to me as I've been like sort of churning on like why I have made this mistake repeatedly, and you know, it's been interesting to notice that I have a much easier time going from he to she or she to he than I do to they. And I think it's an indication for me of just like how like embedded the gender binary is in our thought processes. Like it should, like love isn't enough. If love was enough, I would never have like made the mistake over and over again. You actually have to like pluck out of your brain these like really deep patterns where it's like, nope, there's a binary. There's boys and there's girls and that's it. And like, it's fucking insidious. I mean, that's the thing that I've been getting as I've been really sitting with this over the last week, like, oh, I'm tapped into this really insidious thing that, you know, is this like,
it's your like brain's default. Paranoid. If it is, you it's don't the, it's combat the default. It or...
But it's not even that. I think it's also like, it is the default, and it's also a structure that is structured in a certain way to keep like all sorts of groups down, you know, queer people, women, trans people, NB people, you know what I mean? It's a structure that is designed, and I am participating in my own oppression as a queer woman when I can't fucking get past it. And, you know, and I've been like putting those pieces together a lot more succinctly in my head, I feel like,
and I think,
which probably doesn't mean I'm going to like stop making mistakes, but I think I'm starting to get more of it on like a deeper level of like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually know that there was a term for how I felt and how I existed until I was like 23. I didn't know that I could have a term of non-binary, that it could, there was something that could fit outside. I just thought I was going to be uncomfortable with people saying my name and pronouns because I didn't know there was another option. So
I think when I do it, which I think I probably misgender as often as Yana does, and maybe even more. And I do it a lot in interpersonal conversation with you. And well, a lot being however much I do it in interpersonal conversation with you, Scully. And I feel like when I do, the most kind of honest phenomenological account of what's going on is that. That I take the way that you express, you know, whatever gender dynamic you express, and my brain puts the pieces together and says, there's more of this here. It looks today like there's more of this here than that. Because I thought, I've never misgendered you the other way. I've only misgendered you in the she way. And that's because phenomenologically what I'm seeing is a combination of a lot of different expressions and parts of the spectrum, but I put it together in a way that is, I mean, maybe that's just another way of saying what Yana just said, which is my brain puts it together in the way that I've been programmed for my brain to put it together in terms of, you know, what I think that I'm seeing and
hear. Yeah, and so what does that deprogramming process look like? I mean, that's what's getting more and more interesting to me is like how we fucking deprogram ourselves and stop it.
Well, and like, so when I worked at Kmart, before I knew anything about myself, in terms of gender, really, there was a couple of people who would go into the store and there was one person in particular who had a beard and very strong set jaw and very masculine sounding voice and had very beautiful nails and wore dresses and had beautiful pearls and would curl their hair sometimes. And I have been programmed to use a person's gender expressions and gendered attire as the code for how I refer to them.
Right.
Cues, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, those, yeah, and using those cues as a means, because that was a respect thing for me. That was a way that I could show respect instead of saying, I assume you are a man, so I'm going to use he pronouns. I assume that the gendered clothing that you are currently wearing means you want to be gendered in a feminine way with she, her pronouns. And that is something that I think is still, like, so there are some times where I would tend toward gendering a person that way as opposed to trying, like, I think trying to go toward they for every person that we don't know until you know it is, it was, some people are going to be upset by that though too, because erases, like, so for people who present and take painstaking amounts of time and energy into being like respected as the gender that they are, should also probably, like, that should be something that we do too, is respecting the gender for...
But I think...
it's fucking hard.
I think that's part of the really important work, though. Like, I mean, Yana, you've said, I think, this phrase before of, like, trans and NB people doing really important work around gender that, like, that is, you know, it sort of, like, makes the box less constricting for everyone by, like, challenging, you know, like you were saying, you know, you can make guesses or whatever based on someone's gender cues, but really, like, it should just be what they prefer, like, regardless of how they're presenting
So in times when you get to know the person, is asking is by far the best way, but asking in fairly easily scriptable ways, but there are certain words to try and avoid, like preferred. Pronouns, because it's personal pronouns.
Or just pronouns.
Are your pronouns? What are it sometimes will come out of my mouth, like, to start to say preferred, and so I end up saying personal, because, I was also trained on preferred for a while until I realized, like, wait, no, actually, do I prefer they, them? No, it feels essential to my being, so it's not preferred.
I've switched midstream a few times and gone, like, pronouns.
Yes, what are your pronouns?
That's awesome. So, on this question of they and whether they is too universal to respect, where everyone is personally coming from, it reminds me, that dilemma reminds me also of this very interesting Jacobin article called Imagining the Socialist Bathroom. I believe it's called Imagining the Socialist Bathroom or Restroom. I can't remember. And it's, you know, this notion of if we make the restroom big enough, functional enough, and with enough of the right space, it's sort of this kind of architectural solution to the issue that this is a bathroom anybody, you know, or this is a restroom that anybody can go in. Because it provides privacy for whoever wants it and serves the same function for whoever wants it. And that, to me, like, I always like those solutions, because it's like, oh, that seems like a way that we can actually create something and scale it and design it in the right way, that it's everything, you know, to everyone who uses the restroom, which is everyone. But, you know, that sort of universalization can also be oppressive in instances where that's not the right context, you know, where universalization is not the right context, mm-hmm. and where you have to sort of begin with some kind of individual expression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and so for me the answer is I tend to try and steer toward they, unless when I don't know the person, I do tend to try for they and end up messing up a lot and not doing it and end up falling into the same kind of binary relationships with people. Like, I assume if a person's wearing a dress that I'll say she. That still happens. But I think definitely sitting with the fact that we can do things to be better and we'll never be perfect, that's just a reality that I think is going to be a norm that we have to get comfortable with and or have to sit with the discomfort, because that's where we're at, folks. If we're not going to, like, if heteronormative capitalist white supremacy is not going to be the future, then we still have to figure out what is the future. And it's intersectional, but it's also deeply complex and nuanced within those intersectionalities. And I don't think there's a way that we can actually get to a universal on things. I think there's ways we can get to figuring out how to respect each individual.
What's good, deciding what's good praxis.
Yeah,
it seems like it's more universal process, like things like asking, mm-hmm. like without any judgment about what mm-hmm.
and person and ending your emails with your pronouns and making it so like, and when you introduce yourself in making introductions, like you mentioned, the DSA has done that where they've normalized.
I was just thinking about that and I wanted to bring that up because sort of another iteration of how
normalizing.
Know, of how socialism, you know, is. How some people, you know, take the socialist project as very, very much inclusive of this, and all other, you know, genuine intersectional projects, mm-hmm. because there are also some left organizations and socialist or self-identified socialist, typically communist mm-hmm. organizations that are really shitty on this question, and in fact, violently fascist, I think, on this question. On the transgender question, and one of them posted something on Twitter, and like 10,000 people answered with, "Hey officer, how you doing, officer?" It was some sort of anti-trans screed by some, you know, really distorted, believing themselves to be a communist organization, and it was some sort of trans thing, and like literally thousands of people on Twitter were like, "Cops suck. You're a cop. Hey, officer."
Pigs.
I tweeted, "Dear Officer Krupke, Krupp you." It was glorious. It was a glorious takedown. But on the other hand, more broad-based organizations like DSA and other groups and many other groups that I'm sure I'm not aware of. I mean, we were at this meeting and every single discussion, every small group discussion, every large group discussion, mm-hmm. every introduction of speakers, everything across the board. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people forgot or sometimes people didn't know what to do. But I think that the point was that there's this attempt going on to create that space in every instance, mm-hmm. and in every interaction.
Rattle the cage of the binary whenever possible.
And establish as a norm mm-hmm. That you are either going to ask or self, declare. Mm-hmm. And that after a while, it was, it really just did not seem like anything different than saying what branch you were from or anything else.
Right. Yeah, so putting it in your emails and introducing yourself that way and asking people in a very frank, like, what are your pronouns? And those things seem small, and the more often we do them, the more actually small they become, because it'll be part of, better.
Well, and then, how do we identify, then becomes this freedom in a way that everybody shares.
Yeah. Because it's totally fine to feel comfortable in your own skin. I hope that for people that is preferable.
I think that's part of the problem for a lot of people, though, why they oppose this so vehemently, because underneath it there's a fear of if this is normalized, then part of that, like, you know, you're saying, is that everyone has the opportunity, and it almost becomes, you know, if you have to think about your pronouns, that requires thinking about your gender in a way that I think a lot of people don't allow themselves to, and especially people who, you know, have a lot invested in the binary, particularly, which, like, includes, this actively threatening to them.
Which includes, you know, kind of bourgeois second wave feminists who, and I'm probably going to get shot. I'm probably physically going to get shot or struck with an object for this. But it includes this type of feminism that, you know, rests its entire theory of oppression on
the binary.
That construction.
The presence of a womb.
Yeah.
Really. Mm-hmm. Like the presence of, and specifically, I'm saying womb and not like uterus and like the medical actual term. I'm saying, like, there are people who conceive of oppression as exclusively the fact that you have a womb and the ability to conceive, and that makes you more of a woman than other women, and it's fascinating and infuriating to me, because we were talking a little bit, we were talking earlier about how, yeah, that binary serves to enable further depression. And there are people who say they believe in feminism who exacerbate that binary tremendously, despite saying that gender is also a social construct. Like, yes, so gender is a social construct. Money is a social construct. Lots of shit social constructs.
And still,
they still are real and mean something, and they are also changeable. Like, they are simultaneously something that is present and impactful and subject to change and evolution. And the more you dictate that woman is a very set thing, the more you actually limit your conceptions of feminism and the
ability. Yeah, I'm also thinking about, like, some pain points that, you know, I have a number of friends who have been through breast cancer and have breasts removed and then go through, like, a really intense, like, not knowing who they are anymore because they're, you know, having the body of a woman as defined, you know, their entire life the way that it's been defined. You know, and it certainly isn't true for everybody who I know who, you know, have lost breasts, but it is an interesting thing, like, just like how much pain inadvertently gets caused by this thing, or maybe deliberately by the powers that be or whatever. But I think those of us who have internalized that really strong, like, I'm a woman because of X, Y, or Z, and then what happens when something gets upset? And it's like the source of a tremendous amount of pain for some people. Or not being able to have children for some people is like that.
I mean, I've actually, there's
such unbelievable pain for people in that situation.
Well, and so I'm also, but I'm thinking about that. Like, there's a non-binary person who I know who has been through a situation wherein they are not able to have children ever again. Like, they have very complicated feelings with that, and they go through a large amount of trauma around that. And part of it is that the child's, I can't, of course, speak for them, so but they have expressed the fact that that is something that is very hard on them, and they're going through that also outside of specific gender binary. So there's an added layer of stuff on top of that, even. But I also understand, like, people who, if you have your identity, that just, it just makes me think of all of, like, the trans men who, like, I have that relationship of, like, desire to lose them. Yeah. All of the gender prescripts that we've been given, the prescriptions that are there, are fucking harmful as shit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Word.
It just adds more trauma that doesn't need to be there, you know?
Yeah, because the people who have mastectomies for cancer, like, you are losing cancer!
Mm-hmm. You get to live, and it's losing a part of yourself, and it's losing a part of that is deeply tied to you, and that is fucking unimaginably hard.
Yeah.
On the prevalencies of, like, the overlapping numbers of people, you talk about transhumanist, which immediately makes me think of, like, yeah, the cyberpunk and the transhumanist, like, becoming more integrated with our machinery and technology. That's not necessarily, like, on the trans agenda trademark, but there, I've seen an overwhelming
questioning of the body,
I've also seen an overwhelming, like, a lot of people that I interact with on a regular basis have a definite connection to that technology and a connection to that, like, idea that we can transcend what we have right now, and that involves on our own physical levels, and that involves, like, spiritual transcendence, and it involves people, there's some of my friends who have, like, astrological transcendent goals, but there's also, like, there's a transhumanism and technology are definitely something that I see a relation to with transgender philosophy, and, like, the way that we're trying to declare loudly that we fucking exist.
It reminds
and reassert it.
It reminds me of that idea reminds me of ALOC.
I think it's ALOC. I might be mispronouncing it.
Okay. I haven't heard it before.
Yeah. So ALOC.
I've just seen it on Facebook.
Vladman?
I might
edit some of this stuff out because it's getting a little inside baseball, and plus we're going, what's that word again?
Yeah.
So, but if I do that, then
They have this idea, or they are, you know, sort of constantly espousing this idea of that, which I think's really, like you guys were speaking to, is that we constantly create ourselves, and there doesn't have to be this, like, definition of, you know, there's, like, the bioessentialism, but then there's also kind of this idea that, you know, you have to be one thing. And if that thing changes, then, like, the thing you were before wasn't, like, authentic or wasn't, you know.
Oh, my God, how fucking tedious.
And, yeah, right. And so I think, like, that they're one of the people doing a lot of work around that sort of, like, really revolutionary idea that, you know, that you can constantly recreate yourself and still be valid and authentic and, you know.
Several weeks ago, we recorded and mixed a song about Identity Europa, an absurd and sneaky group of actual fascists, actual nationalists, who stealthily spread white supremacist and anti-immigrant propaganda and have been doing so in towns across Wyoming and the northern front of Colorado. Since we recorded this song, Identity Europa has reformed as the American Identity Movement, but is continuing its same shit. So here's the song anyway, and we'll keep mocking and fighting white supremacists in Wyoming and everywhere else, no matter what they call themselves.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, their leader going bankrupt just wasn't in their plan. So Identity Europa, they skulked up to Cheyenne, unfurled some banners, and then away they ran. Then posted it on Twitter and pretended they had fans. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. And get the fuck out of Wyoming. You really think there's such a thing as white identity? You strip it of all context and cultural history. So even if we did think you were all scumbag Nazis, we'd still make fun of your fucked up epistemology. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. And get the fuck out of Wyoming. Besides, we care and we're concerned your heads will get bashed in, or a sickle blade will go into your neck and out your chin. Or geysers up in Yellowstone will boil off your skin. The safest thing that you could do is not come back again. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off.
know that you're all lonely and not really very strong. We know that you want more than anything to just belong. So do yourselves a favor and listen to this song. Get help or get the fuck away because your shit is wrong. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. And get the fuck out of Wyoming. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. Fuck off, Identity Europa. And get the fuck out of Wyoming.
Marching all together. Good folks, all a word with you. What a world to bring us to. We shall make the world anew, all of us together.
You can support Solidarity House Cooperative and the production of these podcasts, this music, news, and events for Wyoming and the whole world, by going to patreon.com/solidarityhouse and becoming a subscriber. Your support allows us to produce content, host events, give shelter to artists and activists, and create a new community from the ashes of Wyoming's unique brand of extraction, exploitation, and fossil fuel capitalism. We offer an alternative, and we thank you for your support. You can hear us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and at patreon.com/solidarityhouse.
We will up and march away, marching all together. Now our clasping hands we raise, holding high a song of praise, song of hope for better days, all people linked together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Forward stepping row by row, waves of freedom on we flow, singing, shining as we go, comrades all together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together.